Our next speaker is Bruce McKenzie, who will be known to many of you. He's been at the bar for about 15 years. Bruce practices in common law, personal injuries, and does a lot of work cover work. I've worked with him. It's interesting that he's talking about stress. He's probably one of the least stressed people you'll ever see. And sometimes you wonder whether he's actually medicated. So we're going to rouse him from his reverie this morning to make sure that he gives a sparkling talk to you. Could you welcome Bruce, please?
Thank you, David, for those somewhat kind words. Today's talk is addressing the no-fault side of things. Now, Carolyn's covered the common law side of things. This is the no-fault side of things. The paper I've done does cover the things I want to talk about. Really, I just wanted to cover some of the highlights. And this is for all of us dealing with the statutory workers' comp claims in the magistrate's court. There remains the capacity for the county court to deal with the cases, but subsequent to the 2010 amendments to the Act, in real terms, your jurisdiction is likely to be the magistrate's court. And typically, the average client wants to get the matter going. Now, in relation to the first issue, that's one of causation, and there's a couple of concepts in the no-fault side of things that are different to the common law side of things. I won't make the contrast, but you'll see it as we go. Firstly, there's injury in the primary sense versus injury in the extended sense. Injury in the primary sense is a circumstance where, for example, someone has no prior psychiatric condition, but perhaps due to exposure to some traumatic event at work, suffers a psychiatric condition. So that's injury in the primary sense. You just have to have the event happen, for example, and you've established injury. Injury in the extended sense is recurrence, deterioration, aggravation, acceleration, exacerbation, etc., of a pre-existing condition. And that's often the case with the psychiatric injury cases that you come across. And the particular plaintiff might have had some low level of psychiatric problem that has either not required treatment or certainly hasn't been productive of any incapacity for work. And due to workplace events, it becomes more pronounced. The issue then is one of significant contributing factor. And I'll come back to that. The issue of significant contributing factor, though, is the test for when you're talking about injury in the extended sense. As I say, save for the case where you've got a psychiatric injury in an otherwise pristine mind, if I could put it that way, you're dealing with injury in the extended sense, for which you need to show that employment's a significant contributing factor. A couple of useful notes on that, and you'll find those at page 3 and 4 of the paper, are that you can have more than one significant contributing factor. Employment may be a significant contributing factor, even though other factors are more important, such as a marriage breakdown or whatever it is, whatever personal issue you want to nominate. In terms of what significant means, it means more than de minimis, less than major or dominant cause, and alternatively described as of considerable amount or effect. So significant may or may not mean what you think it means when you first read it. There's the illustration given in the case of Sangster. That was a decision before Magistrate Wright. Magistrate Wright is, by virtue of the Magistrate's Court, hearing most of these cases, and Magistrate Wright being the main work cover judge, he's producing most of the judgments. And they're a good guide as to the operation of the provisions, and he's developing the case law as we go, with special guest appearances from time to time by some of the county court judges if matters have progressed. The learning used to be, up until a few years ago, the learning was all coming out of the county court, but in more recent times, by virtue of the increased jurisdiction of the magistrate's court, that's where the learning's coming from. Sangster was a company director. The company was failing. There was stress due to him wearing one hat as a company director, an employee of the company. There was also stress due to being the proprietor of the company. One might think that they'd be pretty hard to disassociate. and ultimately it was decided that you didn't need to disassociate or disentangle them. The important point that is next on the list is that you take your worker as you find them, and the court has pointed out in cases like Slateska that the fact that someone else might not have suffered the particular injury doesn't matter. The employment doesn't need to create any special risk. It is very much no fault. And following on from that, the court goes on to say that the employment issue just has to be a cause. It doesn't have to be the sole or dominant cause. So this overlaps with the significant contributing factor issue. Perception is very important in these cases, and with the qualification that the events in the workplace need to have happened and they can't be imagined or otherwise not have happened, then it's the perception by the worker of those events that's significant. And that's highlighted in the New South Wales case of Chemla, adopted by His Honour Judge Wachoos in Asquith, and ultimately not argued. Asquith was appealed, but the appeal was not on that issue. So this perception issue remains very important, and that's one of the difficulties with the psychiatric injury cases as opposed to the physical injury case, where you know that you can establish positively that the object that was being lifted weighed X, or it was being lifted to a height of Y. All those matters can be verified. With a psychiatric injury case, you get into the subtleties of someone's perception. It doesn't have to be a reasonable perception, it's just the perception. Now, Asquith was a good illustration of the point. Asquith was about a lady who worked for a school. She'd come to the school with something like a 20-year history of psychiatric problems involving intensive psychiatric treatment. And she started to have difficulties, and the difficulties caused her to have time off. And the employer, amongst other things, the employer was ringing up to see how she was going, when she was coming back to work. It hadn't been asserted that there was any workplace event that was causing things, not at that stage. But ultimately it became this snowball or chicken and egg effect of the employer telephoning the worker, making contact and so on, and other events, but matters of that sort, all as found by His Honour to be quite proper and well-intentioned, that fed into the worker's perception that she was being subjected to pressure by the workplace. So the fact that the actions or omissions of the employer may be completely well-intentioned doesn't matter. It goes back to this issue of perception. Did it happen? What was the worker's perception? The credit of the worker obviously becomes important to that issue and every issue. Psychiatric injury cases are very much a case of self-report, and that's why any credit issue takes some significance in a psychiatric injury case, as opposed perhaps to, say, your classic prolapsed back having required surgery. At least you can point to it. So that's one of the subtleties of psychiatric injury cases. The worker will often be, by virtue of the process, I'd suggest, will often be invested with this idea that they're being bullied or they're being harassed. And my own thought is that the internet hasn't helped with a lot of this, and I think people bandy around terms like bullying, harassment, quite liberally, and they could be taken to be buzzwords. They could be taken to be words that people just use to get across the point that they're not happy without any true understanding of what they mean. And analysis of the actual issues at the workplace will often reveal that it wasn't bullying or harassment, it was something else. It was certainly there might have been a difference of opinion, or there might be something that the worker's unhappy with, but the terms bullying, harassment, and matters of that sort tend to get thrown around a bit liberally. And the court will often say at the start of the case, and Turner was one example, the decision of Magistrate Wright in Turner, where I think he said at the very outset that, look, my job's not here to, I'm not here to work out whether there was actual bullying, actual harassment. My job is to determine whether there is injury within the meaning of the Act and what the consequences of that injury are in terms of entitlement under the Act. And it, as recently as last week, he was reminding the plaintiff of that in a particular case. Now, They're the sort of general causation issues, and the other one is causation versus blame. It's no-fault jurisdiction, and you can be the author of your own misfortune to some extent, and that doesn't matter. Now, there's decisions that I've extracted there from Judge Strong in the matter of Ormond and Magistrate Wright in Turner, where, for example, in Turner, Mr. Wright said that I accept the plaintiff may well have been at least partly to blame for this stressful situation he found himself in. Time after time, when you come across these cases, you're dealing with someone who is the worker who's bringing the claim will often be said to be the bully in the workplace. They're not inconsistent concepts, and you can, I certainly have, but no doubt all of you have encountered cases where the star witness for the employer is off with their own stress claim due to allegations of bullying against them, which makes running a Section 82-A defence problematic in some cases. So it's causation, not blame. Again, this is the no-fault side of things. Now, you then move on to what does it all mean in terms of entitlement. You've got three types of, in the statutory scheme, you've got three broad types of entitlement to compensation: weekly payments for incapacity, medical and like expenses, a lump sum for permanent impairment. Incapacity is the issue that most clients are at court about. And in that respect, it's the concept of injury or incapacity requires the incapacity to result from or be materially contributed to by the injury. You don't need to really trouble yourself if, in relation to that. In most cases, that will follow. It's hard to conceive of the typical stress claim, if I can put it that way, not resulting in or materially contributing to the injury. The test is a fairly low one. As His Honour Justice Ashley and Gretch said, the injury doesn't have to be the sole cause, and a consequence here in incapacity can have a multiplicity of causes. So again, similar concepts to what you have in terms of causation. The real issue that's starting to bite in more recent years is the idea of capacity for pre-injury employment. This was highlighted in a decision of Judge Bowman in Kerridge. And Mr. Kerridge was a tyre fitter. It's a decision from about 2009. It picks up on the reasoning of the High Court in Arnott and Yacoub. But in Kerridge's case, this really highlighted it for the purposes of our scheme. Mr. Kerridge was a tyre fitter, had an issue with a manager at a particular branch, brought his claim. By the time the claim was heard, the manager was long gone. The psychiatric evidence was that he could do the work as a tyre fitter there at that workplace if Bloggs wasn't there, or at another workplace. And on that basis, and the reservations that His Honour had in relation to the plaintiff generally, but on that basis primarily, His Honour found that there was no incapacity within the meaning of the Act, because incapacity means that you can't do your pre-injury job. If you can do it at another place or at the same place without that person there, then that's not incapacity. There's been a couple of follow-on concepts that have come out of that, and they've been, again, from Magistrate Wright. Lack of confidence may or may not be enough to establish incapacity. In the case of Burns, there was reservations by the plaintiff, and also in particular the plaintiff's treating psychologist, about getting back on the horse straight away, and there were reservations about, there was a lack of confidence on the part of the plaintiff and the psychologist as to whether the worker could actually do the job. His Honour suggested that, or found that that wasn't incapacity as such. But on the other side of things, if the lack of confidence is a manifestation of is merely a symptom of a bigger psychiatric condition, an anxiety or depressive condition, that of itself causes the incapacity, then that's established, the incapacity is established. The other qualification that's come through is lack of qualification. That was highlighted in a decision of Rogers. This is Magistrate Wright's Rogers, not Judge Parrish's Rogers, which I'll come to. Rogers was a teacher who, along the way, had been promoted from one type of teaching to another type of teaching, and he couldn't deal with it, and he couldn't cope with it, and he had a breakdown as a result of that. And His Honour found, Magistrate Riding Rogers found that he'd had a period where he'd been incapacitated, but ultimately the longer term problem with him working at this higher role was he was never suited for the higher role by virtue of a lack of qualifications, skills, training, etc. And he found that that wasn't incapacity, it was inability to perform the work from the outset. So it didn't create an entitlement to weekly payments. And the third concept that's coming through is the vindication / justification. A lot of the time, there's an element of the plaintiff having a particular issue with a particular person in the defendant, within the defendant's organisation, or the organisation as a whole. And that theme will often come out in psychologist material, whether it's in the reports themselves or in the clinical notes. You sometimes get it in the GP's material, sometimes in the psychiatrist material, but often it's in the psychologist material that you see that. And it's been found that in a decision of Castellucci that if the only thing that is driving you is wanting vindication, and that's the only thing stopping you going back to work, then that's not incapacity. Now, it's going to be a subtle thing from case to case as to what the situation is. It's borne out very much by the opinions of the treating psychologists. Castellucci was a case in which the treating psychologist conceded, based on the notes and the reporting, that was the case, that the plaintiff could go back to that job somewhere else or without the particular manager, but this case had taken on a life of its own. Then we move on to Section 82.2A. Section 82.2A, pre the 5 April 2010 amendments, looked like this. A well-loved form, but of decreasing relevance. This is the new and improved Section 82.2A, which is to be read in conjunction with Section 82.10. It's broken it up. 82.2A, the old form was all in 82.2A. Now it's new and improved and expanded. And the intention I'll come to, but the intention was essentially to simplify it, but also expand the classes of activity that were covered by it. So instead of it being the more restricted list of transfer, demote, discipline, redeploy, retrench, dismiss, etc., it's been expanded to this list in subsection 10 of section 82. Management action means A to M, really, and then N is the catch-all. It's any communication in relation to any of those. It is broad, and it was discussed. The second reading speech was discussed by Magistrate Garnett in a decision of Krieg's. I can never recall. In Kriegsman Yeats. Now, I've covered that at the paper at. Here we are at page 18. And I've extracted what His Honour said in relation to what was intended by the amendments. A couple of points. If you look at page 19, the third bullet point, provide greater clarity and certainty for both workers and employers, and drop down two bullet points to provide protection for employers when undertaking appropriate and fair management actions as intended by the legislature when introducing section 82.2A in 1992. It goes on in the next paragraph to talk about encouraging employees to appropriately and reasonably manage workplace activities. Over the page it talks about clarifying the definition of management action to include contemporary management practices, but to preserve the protection afforded to workers who suffer injury from unreasonable employment circumstances. The thing that you need to keep in mind, and is obvious to everyone, I suggest, is that 82(2)(a) is a disentitlement provision. In circumstances where the worker otherwise ticks all the boxes, satisfies all the requirements for causation, incapacity, need for treatment, and so on, Section 82(2)(a) is a complete bar to the entitlement, if it's successful. And it's for that reason that there's been a fairly tough approach taken by the courts to the application of Section 82(2)(a), tough in the sense that they're not overly keen to impose it, to disentitle a worker who otherwise satisfies all the requirements. And that is perhaps so because if it was a physical injury, there's no equivalent. The fact that you suffered a physical injury by virtue of reasonable management action wouldn't stop you being entitled to no-fault compensation. So perhaps that's the rationale behind it. There's some consideration about what's going to happen with this list. This is modelled on the Commonwealth legislation. The interesting thing is that in the Commonwealth legislation, it refers to administrative action versus management action. Now, there might be a subtle difference between administrative action and management action as to what's intended, particularly perhaps when you look at the second reading speech insofar as it talks about managing workplace activities as opposed to administering the workplace. That's a subtlety that will no doubt keep us all entertained for some time to come. The other note of caution with the Commonwealth decisions is that they don't have wholly or predominantly in their provision anymore, so that the management action just has to be a cause, and it's for that reason that a lot of the Commonwealth claims fail. And just if you happen to be looking at any of the Commonwealth decisions, just bear that in mind, that that's what an essential difference is. Now, in terms of what reasonableness means, thankfully it remains fertile ground for everyone. And in paragraph 56, you have one of the more recent decisions of His Honour Judge Parish in Rogers and the Police Association Credit Co-op. And in that, His Honour adopted the Court of Appeals, New South Wales Court of Appeals reasoning in Department of Education and Sinclair. Interestingly, he says that a course of conduct may still be reasonable even if the particular steps are not reasonable. The whole disciplinary process might, notwithstanding blemishes, amount to reasonable action. Now, discipline is the default almost for 82(2)(a). It seems that most of the 82(2)(a) cases seem to be about discipline, but you can substitute any of the other management actions for discipline wherever you see it. Now, His Honour Magistrate Garnett in Kriegsman Yates adopted a similar sort of approach. Again, he was applying some federal court authority on the idea. And he says that the judgment required, or he quotes the federal court, the judgment required in applying the section is whether the thing was done reasonably, not whether it may have been done more reasonably or in a different manner more acceptable to the court. Brackets my emphasis. Now, that's his magistrate Scarnett's emphasis, not mine. So that's the $64,000 question. Was it reasonable? And as long as these cases exist, you'll never have any consensus on the point, I'd suggest. The sort of things that I've highlighted in paragraph 58 are the sorts of things that the court looks at. Notice given, support people. It used to be union representatives coming along, now it's a support person is suggested. The opportunity to be heard and so on. A lot of those factors are probably more directed at the discipline situation as opposed to what's now included, which is counselling. Counselling is paragraph B. That's arguably a less formal process. Query whether you need to measure it with this standard of rigour. Expectation is, let's move ahead. Onus is, it's a mixed onus. You can combine factors. Wholly or predominantly means what it says. Wholly means what it says, certainly. Predominantly has been contrasted with significantly, so it seems that predominantly means more than significant. Reasonable, I've covered. Expectation is paragraph C. It's, on one view, a bit of a catch-all as to circumstances where the action hasn't occurred. A couple of things in relation to the expectation. It's subjective. That the Court of the Supreme Court Justice Nathan tells us that in Blythman, so it's the expectation of the worker. Another matter is highlighted by Judge Strong, it's the expectation of reasonable action taken in a reasonable manner, management action being taken on reasonable grounds in a reasonable manner as it now is. It's not the expectation of unreasonable activity. So that's a point of some distinction. And the curious thing about expectation is that the employer can invoke expectation even if the worker didn't have the... the employer can invoke the expectation ground on the basis that the worker thought that something was going to happen even if the employer itself didn't intend such. And that was accepted by the Court of Appeal in Unsworth, where it was a teacher who incorrectly believed the employer was going to dismiss them. Just a couple of practical tips, which didn't make themselves into the paper. Lay witnesses. It's important in these cases, because there's so much he says, she says, to marshal your witnesses. If you're acting for the worker, get hold of any lay witnesses. It's not good enough to have your client tell you in conference or tell your barrister in conference on the day of the hearing that I've got three witnesses who all back up what I say, but you don't have them. It's caused more than one adjournment that I've seen. You need to see what they're going to say. For the employer, you need to see what they're going to say, and it's not good enough to simply go on what statements might have been given to investigators, where they're typically given on the basis of an absence of full understanding of what the worker's allegations are, and they're non-responsive to the central allegations made by the worker. And it wouldn't be the first time that you have the conference with the lay witnesses for the employer and they say, oh, yeah, well, that happened, but... And they're hanging their hat on something that really isn't central to the case. So there needs to be that activity. You need to get hold of relevant documents. I don't want to encourage discovery in each case, but you need to see clinical records, you need to see employer records, you need to see email correspondence such as was adverted to before. You need, again, the medical records to see what the issues were, and your psychiatric evidence needs to address issues such as incapacity, the carriage point, whether the person's incapacitated for the work here, there and everywhere, or matters of that sort. And the psychiatric evidence for the defendant especially needs to address the wholly or predominantly issue. They shouldn't get into the realm of the reasonableness of the action, but they should. You need them to provide some opinion on that wholly or predominantly issue. Otherwise, good luck.
Thanks very much, Bruce. Again, a very interesting talk, and the paper is even more thorough. Now, there's time for some questions. If you do have a question, could you put your hand up and we'll bring a microphone over to you, and could you direct it to one, or if you like, both of the speakers?
By the nature of the injuries, the plaintiff is never really going to be a great witness. How do you overcome that without other lay witnesses to back up their story?
Do you want to do that, Caroline, or?
That's absolutely an issue in all the matters I talked about today, that the plaintiff wasn't accepted for various reasons, either relating to their illness or to what was found to be a difference between their perception and the reality of the matters. I suppose seeking out whatever corroborative evidence possibly can be sought by casting a wide net for other lay witnesses. In Brown, it wasn't just the senior partners involved that gave evidence. There were lots of other people in the workplace that gave evidence. It wasn't helpful evidence to the plaintiff in the end, but that's certainly an avenue of investigation. And I suppose using those steps like interrogatories to at least understand in detail the opposing evidence can at least give a good indication well ahead of trial of the sorts of weaknesses that are likely to be raised, and so at least you can make a targeted attempt to seek or shore up any potential weaknesses in the plaintiff's evidence if for some reason there's likely to be a problem accepting their evidence. But I agree, that's extremely difficult.
Yeah, I was just going to chime in. The contemporaneous reporting to the treating just slip of the tongue. thankfully it's been videoed. The treating general practitioner or the treating psychologist, particularly if the treating psychologist is engaged prior to the events, but contemporaneous reporting in, say, the going back to the work, the no-fault side of things, if the management action is they were counselled on this date, but for months, if not years before that, the plaintiff was off seeing the doctor saying, look, this supervisor is on my case all the time, he's harassing me, whatever. Those matters are very important to substantiating the plaintiff's case. And in Castellucci, the manager was accused of sexual harassment, and the plaintiff produced witnesses that in relation to some of the key events. So any sort of lay witnesses you can get are absolutely worth their weight in gold, whether they be lay witnesses for the events or medical practitioners taking accounts of earlier problems, symptoms especially, and complaints and difficulties in the workplace.
There's one other matter too, and that's that often you say that the plaintiff may not be much of an advocate for their own cause, and that's true, but bearing in mind that the employer has to take the victim as he or she finds the victim, a person who comes across as a frail and vulnerable person to a jury will also give that impression to a manager, and the manager might have to take particular care with that personality in the way in which they're treated in the workplace. So just because a person may not come across as a particularly good witness, that doesn't mean that their case is fraught because of that. Okay. Well, I can see you're all stretching to get back to work. So thank you all for coming out on this cold and early morning. You'll be kept up to date and informed of what other talks are coming up on the Greens List mailing list. So thank you for coming. Thank you again to the speakers. And we'll see you next time.